Okay, everybody, I'd like to welcome you all back to the second half of the day. I hope everybody enjoyed their lunch. And I'd just like to invite Tiffany up from the Landscape Designers Group to introduce the first of our speakers for the second half of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your meal. Our next speaker today is Rob Canali. Rob is a former landscape contractor and an honorary member of Landscape Ontario. He now practices construction law with McLaughlin and Associates out of both Toronto and Simcoe offices. His day-to-day practices involve negotiations, contract drafting, construction lien and trust claims, claims involving owners, consultants, and insurers, as well as tendering issues, building code violations, claims against performance and labor and material payment bonds, Workplace Safety and Insurance Act claims, and Occupational Health and Safety Act issues. Rob also speaks regularly on construction law issues as well as literary. Please join me in welcoming Rob Canali.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Chuck. Thank you, Tiffany. I did practice landscape design, build construction. Eventually decided I wanted a different outfit, went to law school, and now I do construction law. I know what it is that you guys do for a living. I've been doing this area of law for about 20 years, and one of the first things I did when I got out of law school was go to LO and get involved in education for LO members, because I realized in my first year of law school that what I didn't know about the law of what I was diving into could really wipe me out. And that's been a bit of a 20-year process. I know this morning somebody here was speaking about the future of landscape design. I do nothing but construction law, from small projects through to huge commercial projects. And I'll tell you that yours is an industry, as designers and as contractors as well, that's sort of on the verge of exploding a little bit. We're seeing increasingly municipalities that are requiring, they used to say, we're going to pre-qualify three trades, structural, mechanical, and electrical, because they're the most important. You'd be stunned how often, as some of you are coming to know, that the landscape trade is now being added to the list, pre-qualifying, getting specialized designers in, because people are starting to realize that the landscape design aspects of construction are nothing like the other interior building aspects of construction. So I think that's a good thing. I think it's coming. What my role today and overall is, you know, you come to Congress, you get involved in learning more about what it is you do for a living, and this is all towards building better designs and making more money. What I'm here to help you figure out is how to avoid losing money, how to avoid losing your shirt. And it can be easy in any business that you're trying to develop to focus on making the money and not on risk management and risk allocation. So what I want to talk today about a little bit is risk management in your business from the perspective of what's unique to your business. I've got about an hour and 10, 15 minutes. We'll try to get some questions in at the end. It's not going to be possible for me to cover everything I'm talking about in depth. But hopefully what I can point you to is, or are, things that you will need to think about, things you'll need to dot the I's and cross the T's with and go from there. So let's get started. I'm going to talk today about the design responsibility, which seems brain dead obvious, but is not as simple as it sounds. We're going to talk about your contracts. We're going to talk about cost estimates and your role in providing them. We're going to talk about inspection of the work and your role in doing that, selecting or recommending contractors, and finally, the Construction Lien Act, very briefly, as it might apply to what you do for a living. Design versus build. The contractor is the person in the usual circumstance who's hired to build the contract, the design that is provided to the contractor by the owner. So the owner says, here's the design, build it. and your role is in providing that design. This is in the classic general bid-build circumstance where the contractor bids, gives a price to build to the owner's design. The design consultant must provide a design which performs as intended and meets the needs of the client. One example I always use is, if you're hired to build a water feature for a client, it's going to involve a waterfall, it's going to involve a stream, it's going to involve a water course, and the client wants, obviously, the water feature to he wants it to be ecologically functioning properly. He's not going to want mold and mildew and all this stuff growing. He wants the water to keep moving. And he says to you, I want to put fish in the pond. And you draw something up, and you do the design, and it turns out at the end of the day that you needed to go down more than 4 feet to get enough water into this thing so that the fish would be able to survive through the winter. And it turns out that getting the feature to perform properly, ecologically, your pump specifications were way undersized. And accordingly, your conduit specs were way undersized. And to do what the client actually wanted is rip it out, go down a lot deeper, put in footings, put in concrete, put in reinforced concrete, put in a much bigger pump, and put in bigger conduit. So what is the client's damages because of your error in design? Well, it's not a matter of you're not getting paid. If your design was contemplated construction at about $25,000, $26,000, $27,000, and it turns out that what the client really needed was something that was going to cost about $500,000, then arguably you're on the hook for the difference. So you need to be a little careful in your business about overreaching. If you're going to start designing into new areas and putting your designer's hat and getting into areas that you're not sure of, be a little careful, because there's potentially more at stake than just the amount of money that's on the table in your contract. Contractors not generally going to be responsible for design deficiencies. He's building to your design in the usual circumstance, unless he somehow assumes design responsibilities. The designer won't be responsible for defects in workmanship. You design it. The contractor doesn't build it in accordance with your design, and he's not going to avoid responsibility for his defects in workmanship, right? He screws up the work. As long as your design was fine, you should be off the hook. If the contractor assumes design responsibilities, though, things change. This is in the classic contractor builds it, you design it. If the contractor starts changing your design, he's putting on a designer's hat. He's got to wear that. And you do. You're going to find circumstances where the contractor starts making changes in the field. And if you're not going to, your knee-jerk reaction to that should be, if somebody changes my design, I no longer warrant my design. Full stop, period. You want that in your contracts. I stand behind my design, but if you tweak it without my written approval, I'm not standing behind that design if he or the owner suddenly decide to put on their own designer's hat. Now, this is important. The contractor is generally not going to assume the risk of defects in design. The point about this slide is he doesn't have insurance for that. Okay? Understand the insurance implications of what you're doing. You design it, they build it. They don't generally have insurance for design. They have what's known as a CGL policy, Comprehensive General Liability, which is a policy that covers errors in their workmanship, accidents, unintended consequences of the work. But those policies will generally exclude errors in design. Right in the policy, it'll say, we're not covering you for design. Designers, those of you who are doing designers work, those of you who are administering contracts, need what's known as errors and omissions insurance. It's the type of insurance that I have for my screw-ups. I'm not building anything. It's my advice. It's my consultation that is giving you advice. There is a member of your group who remain nameless who, like 20 years ago, had the broker of the company say, here's your insurance policy. And the designer was paying for this policy for years and years and years, and the company was like ABC Design Inc. And when a problem arose, the insurance company came back and said, well, you have a CGL policy that excludes design. Like, how the broker ever gave this designer insurance that didn't cover design at all when all the company did was design was a little ridiculous. You have to make sure you've got errors and omissions insurance. And if you don't, you better solve that problem in a hurry. The designer, you've got or errors and omissions insurance, but it's not generally going to cover you for workmanship. They're going to ask you declarations when you ask for your policy and you're getting errors and omissions insurance, and they're going to be asking you about what you build and the extent to which you build. And many of you will have said, no, I'm just a designer. And some of you are going to start moving into doing a little bit of the physical work. Well, you better ask yourself, firstly, if you're going to move into doing a little bit of the physical work, and I'm talking about even planting things, are you insured for it? Because if you've got a standard errors and omissions insurance policy, you may not be. Let's talk about the consultant's role in construction. Well, the consultant is generally the owner's representative. The owner is hiring you to prepare a design on his or her behalf. The consultant does not generally perform the physical work, and we'll come back to physical work and your interest in maybe doing some planting and stuff later on. A consultant who does do some of the physical work, let's just make it clear, you are now a design build contractor. Right? You're now no longer just a designer. You're assuming some of the obligations for the physical work. And as we'll talk about in a moment, you need to understand what risks and obligations you're assuming when you do that. Let's talk about the contract a little bit. The contract needs to be, if you are in the classic circumstance where you're going to design it and somebody else is going to build it, your contract has to be with the owner. Unless you want to assume responsibility for the physical work, you contract with the owner and the contractor contracts with the owner. This is wrong. Unless you're planning on building it, you can't set up your contracts like this, because if you set up your contracts like this, you are now the contractor. It's as simple as that. If the owner is paying you for the work and you're going to pay the contractor because you've decided you want to take control of the work and make sure that the guy who does it properly and you don't want to leave any loose ends and have somebody drive by and say, oh, that's Jane's design, and you've lost control of the work because the guy that came in to do it didn't know what he was doing and you think the best way to control that is to actually hire the contractor, well, that is buying more risk than you want to buy. I absolutely guarantee it, and I'll tell you more about why in a second. Some of you want to do that because you get a markup, right? Hear that all the time. I want to hire the contractor because I have a markup. I don't need to disclose that to the owner. It's just a better pricing mechanism. It works for me. Not at that price, not at that risk. That's the wrong way to do it unless you're doing the physical work. The consultant under this model will assume all of the contractor's obligations for workmanship. You set it up like this, you are the constructor for the purposes of occupational health and safety legislation. You are responsible for all of the health and safety of everything that goes underneath you in that project. You are the builder. You're responsible for insurance. E&O isn't going to cut it. You're going to need insurance for every piece of work that goes in there. You're going to need be responsible for all of the WSIB and the clearance certificates of everybody underneath you. You're going to be responsible for the licensing. You're going to be responsible to make sure that the Occupational Health and Safety Act is followed. Right then, you know, the construction regulation 201, it's like this thick. How many of you have read it? How many of you are ready to implement it on a job site? The idea that you guys are going to assume the contractor's role by having the money flow you through the contractor is a very bad idea. Don't do that unless you know what's involved in being a contractor and you are insured for it. Really, what you are in that circumstance is a contractor who has subcontractors, and that's not the model you want to use. This is the model you want to use. This is the standard model in construction. when it's a bid-build circumstance. The consultant contracts with the owner directly, and the contractor contracts with the owner directly. And what you do is prepare the design, and sometimes what you do is you actually prepare the form of the contract that the contractor and the owner will enter into, and sometimes you will administer that contract, approving the change orders, reviewing the work, doing site inspections, etc., which we'll talk about in a moment. Sometimes you will assist the owner in selecting a contractor, whether it's a full-blown tender process or not. So you will have a role, potentially, over here, right? You'll have a role in that relationship between owner and contractor, but you can't set it up and put yourself in the middle because the risks are too great. So how do you keep control? I hear it all the time. Consultants say, well, you know, I don't want to do up a design and have the owner hire some kid with a pickup truck to try to install it, and everybody's going to say that that's Bill's work. How do you control it? Well, one of the ways that you do control it is that you help your client out. You get paid for it, but you help your client out, and you get paid for drafting this contract. Right, that contract right there, you draft it. Consultants generally do that. Say to the owner, this is the design, and these are the terms of the contract that the owner and the contractor are going to enter into. If you don't draft it, you want a role in reviewing it and a role in determining whether it's okay. And one of the things that you want to make sure is in that contract between the owner and the contractor is that you are appointed as the owner's consultant. You look at commercial projects, there's always a big C consultant. The owner is appointed the consultant as his representative on site. And so far as the contractor is concerned, when the consultant says jump, the contractor says how high. When the consultant says, I need you to give me notice before you backfill that wall because I need to know that the tiebacks are in place, he's got to give you notice. You know, and if you don't do that, if you don't have your rights in that contract set out, if you don't have your role in that contract set out, you'll go to the contractor one day and say, I need the opportunity to inspect the wall before you backfill it. So make sure that you give me about a day's notice before you do it and I'll be there. And the contractor may look at you and say, I'm sorry, who are you? You're a complete stranger to me. I have no obligations to you whatsoever. Get out of my way. I'm not going to slow down my production because you want to come and look over my shoulder. So the way you control it is you make sure that in that relationship between owner and contractor, and this is standard in construction, your role is spelt out and the contractor has to play ball with you. And what you want to ensure that you have is reasonable access to the work to perform your inspections, etc., throughout. You'll want to ensure that if the contractor wants to change your design, he's going to have to issue a change request, which is going to come through you, and there aren't going to be any surprises. Again, it must be spelt out in the contract. Now, keep in mind that in this classic scenario, you are the owner's consultant, you're hired by the owner, you're working for the owner, but in law, as you're administering a contract, is this a change, is it not a change, is the contractor entitled to be paid, is he not entitled to be paid, is the contractor, is his work deficient, does he need to fix this or that? In law, you have to be unbiased. You have to have a third-party unbiased look at these things, even though you're working for the owner. It's a tight, tight rope to walk, you know, and contractors generally don't believe that you walk it well. They always think that you're in the owner's pocket. But you're supposed to walk that tight rope and be unbiased in doing these reviews. Contracts in general, the first comment I'm going to make is beware the Consumers Protection Act. I'm not going to say very much more about it because I've only got a little bit of time, but at the end of the day, if you're working with a homeowner as opposed to a business, somebody who isn't retaining you as part of their business, they're a consumer for the purposes of the Consumers Protection Act, and the Consumers Protection Act is going to set out the form of the contract that has to be in place, you know, how the I's get dotted, how the T's gets crossed. They're going to set out various rules And so protecting yourself with contracts in the residential construction context, if you really want to manage your risk, make sure that you're in compliance with the Consumer Protection Act. The importance of a detailed scope of work. Your contracts have to spell out who, what, where, when, and how the work is being done. Some example: size, scale, calipers, colors. I remember when I first started in this business, I was absolutely surprised that this small little company was going to the taking the time to be so detailed in their designs so as to set out the sizes of the shrubs and the calipers of the trees. And I know that that's very standard in what you do, but you'd be surprised how many people don't do that. Horror story. When I was working in construction, I'm standing there, and the stonemason is putting down a patio, random Cascade or Wyerton flagstone. And the owner comes by, the consultant was nowhere to be found. The owner comes by and he looks down at the patio and he goes, "That's not what I paid for." And the trade is like, "What?" And he says, "Look, here's the design." And he holds up the design that has the random flagstone drawn out, little pieces of a jigsaw puzzle drawn out. So some of you are starting to laugh because this owner was a bit of a clown, you might think, and he was saying to the contractor, "No, I want it to match I want the jigsaw puzzle to match the drawing." And you laugh because, of course, the contractor says, "Well, the trade says I'm going to have to get out a diamond blade and cut the jigsaw pieces, and that's going to be kind of expensive." But then it turns out that the owner wasn't such a moron after all. He wasn't so concerned about the dimensions of the jigsaw puzzle. He was concerned about the sheer size. And this consultant, without thinking about it, had drawn great big jigsaw puzzles, like pieces of slab that would be 6 by 8 feet. And the owner thinks he's going to have this phenomenal patio, and he comes and he's got these little 1 foot square pieces of jigsaw puzzle and says, "Understandably, that's not what I paid for." And I just rolled my eyes and walked around to the other front of the house because this had nothing to do with me and I have no idea how they sorted it out. But that's a problem. The more detail that you can put in your contracts with your owner, the better. One of the big differences, and one of the reasons the municipalities are saying we want landscape trades and landscape designers, is when you walk into a house and you talk to a homeowner about what her kitchen's going to look like, or what the master bedroom's going to look like, or the staircase, they live and they breathe in those environments. They know what that stuff's going to look like. They understand it in three dimensions. A lot of your clients don't have a clue what it is you're trying to sell them. And I know that with the design programs that we have and three-dimensional imaging and stuff, it's getting a lot better, but there's sometimes still a disconnect there. You need to start explaining to them about natural imperfections in flagstone. You need to make sure that you've explained to them stuff about density and growth. I remember this woman standing there with me and saying, "That looks awfully bare," after we were done. And I said, "Well, the shrubs need an opportunity to grow a little bit. And if we'd actually installed it so that it looked bountiful and plush, it would be completely overgrown by next summer." And she said to me, "Yeah, but the only reason we did this is because we're having a wedding in the backyard next month." And I went to Annabelle's and we borrowed about $100,000 worth of plants and installed them for 1 weekend and then brought them back and solved the problem. But that's because my client didn't understand. I had clients that when we faced the treads of natural stone said, "I don't like the jagged edge, the natural face." And I said, "Well, I can take a diamond blade to it and make it smooth, but you're not going to like it. I guarantee it, you're not going to like it." I said, no, I can't have that. Take the diamond blade to it. "Oh, I don't like that," right? So, it's your job to make sure that because your industry is unique, your clients understand what they're getting for their money. Contracts are not only about scope of work. You'd be surprised, less so with designers and more so with contractors. All they do is give a scope of work. I get your design, I price it and say, "I'm going to do that design for $100,000, and that's my contract." And that's silly, because that does nothing more than put a price on the work. And contracts are about allocating risk. Who's responsible for what? And the contractors need to know about sequence and access and all this other stuff. You guys need to know about permits. Who's responsible for getting the permits? Who's responsible for determining where the lot lines are? Are you just going to rely on the owner's advice? And if so, are you saying so in your contract? What about bylaws and other land use restrictions? I could stand up here for an hour and tell you about the problems I've had with landscape designers that all of a sudden found out that they were told to build a gazebo in the middle of what turned out to be the Oak Ridges Moraine. And but we're told to build it there. And so who's responsible for that? The contracts need to deal with this stuff. Engineering requirements. What about the contractor who says, oh, don't worry, or the owner who says, oh, don't worry about that. You know, you build it without a permit. Happens all the time. You need to deal with it in your contract. Acknowledgement and indemnities. Your owner, your client wants you to don't worry about something. You know, build it. I know it's 8 feet high. Just build it. Don't get an engineering report. Acknowledgements. Indemnities. You're acknowledging you told me to do it against my advice. What about unsafe conditions that you're in there and you're going, holy cow, this tree's coming down. That's not what I'm hiring you for. You know, okay, get an acknowledgement. Get an indemnity. I'm not buying this risk. It's about allocation of risk. Be careful. Let's talk about estimates. Most of your contractors want to know how much it's going to cost to build this thing. And you say, I think you can probably get that in for about $200,000. Are you sure? Right? The Consumer Protection Act, in a really weird way, says nobody's allowed to charge a consumer more than 10% over and above the estimate. And we say to contractors, don't give estimates. The difference between, for the contractor, is when you go to Canadian Tire, and you say, I need to have my car fixed, Canadian Tire never gives you an estimate. They say, we're going to charge you $45 to do the 17-point inspection, and then we're going to call you up and say, this is what you need, and then you're going to agree to a firm price. They never say, it's going to be about this amount of money. You need to try to be careful with the estimates. Your clients want them. You're going to have to give them, but your contract's going to have to set out that this is provided for information purposes only, and all of the factors that can go into shooting an estimate out of your hands. It's going to depend on the bid process, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because Madam Justice Beverly McLaughlin, who is this Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, wrote the seminal book on engineering law in Canada. And when you look at that book, it says that when a design consultant gives an estimate, says that the work's going to cost about $200,000, and then it goes out to tender and it comes back and they all come back at $350,000. The owner doesn't have to pay you. And the owner doesn't have to pay you because your design is now worthless. Because he's not going to install a $350,000 design. You knew he had $200,000 in his pocket. He might be able to get to $225,000. Don't be giving him a $350,000 design. You won't get paid. And if you're walking a bit of a tightrope and you're not sure about the estimate, your contract needs to deal with it. You know, these are concept drawings, and the final price is going to be dependent on the finishing details that you put in, and it's going to be depending on what the engineer says, and yada, yada, yada. But the yada, yada, yada needs to be in there. Because, God help you, you don't want to be paying my hourly rate to get into the yada, yada, yada in front of a judge. It's way too expensive. If the estimate's not to be relied on, it better be clear in the contract. Inspections and site supervision. Who here does site supervision? Put your hands down. And make a note to strike those words from your vocabulary. I don't ever want to hear them again. Those of you who put up your hands and said, I do site supervision, are you on site every day? Are you standing behind the contractor? Are you looking over his shoulder to make sure that he gets everything done? Absolutely not. You're not being paid to be a site superintendent. The contractor has a foreman or a site superintendent that has to be there every day. It's his job to do site supervision. It's not your job. What consultants do is, so you don't do that. Don't say that you do that. Strike the words from your vocabulary. What consultants generally do is attend at key stages of the work to review the status of the work to ensure, and these are the magic words, general conformity with the construction documents. We get architects and engineers and discoveries and litigation, and it's like pulling a bloody string out of their back. You know, didn't you intend to inspect on that day? Well, you know, all I really did was intend to do a general review of the status of the work to ensure general compliance with the construction documents. But that's all you can do, and that's all you can say. You're not there every day. So you pick the key stages of the work. It's why you say to the contractor, I want to be there to look behind the wall and ensure that the tiebacks are in before you backfill it. You know, you might want to see that the filter cloth is there. You might want to see the compaction tests on the footings before something's poured. You figure out what the key stages are. You do your due diligence on those stages, but you're not standing behind everything that happens in the interim. And your clients need to understand that you're not site supervising. It's your clients need to understand that your client wants you to guarantee the workmanship. Okay, my price just went up because I have to be there every minute of every day. It's just a risk allocation. The owner's not going to pay you for that, and accordingly, you know, you've got to back off what it is you can provide. And it's up to the owner in a way. You know, what stages do you want me to review? Make it clear in your contract what you're responsible for and what you're not responsible for, and please strike the word site supervision from your vocabulary. Sourcing contractors. I've heard it all. So, yeah, you don't want some guy on a truck that you've never heard of showing up to do your work. You want a little bit of control to make sure that the guy who's doing it is qualified. And you will tell me that your owners want you to do that as well. Your clients are saying, do you know somebody who can do the work? And you're going to say yes. Or you might even be ahead of that and say, oh yes, and we have two or three contractors that we work with all the time, and they're very good, and we work well with them, and they're great, and you should use them. All of which makes really good sense. There's two aspects of this that I want you to consider. One is and I'm not going to back up the slide, but you remember the slide I showed you that we had the owner, and then we had the consultant and the contractor? And we go to all this trouble to make sure that my deal is with the consultant and the owner's deal is with the contractor. One of the reasons you do that is so that at the end of the day, when you've done interim inspections and created your deficiency list, and you say to the contractor, these are the deficiencies you need to correct. If the contractor doesn't do it, it's not your problem. All you've done is say to the owner, now you need to chase the contractor. And if the contractor says they're not deficiencies, it's still, at first instance, a battle between the owner and the contractor. But there are also circumstances where the owner isn't happy, and the owner says, oh my God, I had one that wanted all of the soldier course in the interlock cut so that there were no gaps at the end of the interlocking. And the contractor properly was saying, well, no, that's not what you're paying for. And a dispute arises, and the consultant says, no, that's not what you're paying for. You know, in circumstances where the owner isn't happy with the contractor, it may not be the best example, in circumstances where the owner is not happy with the contractor and is saying your work is deficient, even if you've gone to the care of setting it up so that the owner ends up having to have the dispute with the contractor, if you've sold the owner on the contractor, right? I am going to back this up. You go to all the trouble in the world to set this up, to isolate yourself from this environment, which means if the contractor doesn't get paid, it's between them. Which means if there are deficiencies in the work that the contractor won't correct, it's between them. If the contractor is trying to argue that the owner is completely out there in terms of his expectations, it's between them. But at the end of the day, if you have gone down the road and sold the owner, and I'm telling you, I've seen this happen 3 or 4 times. You've run down the road and sold the owner on the idea that you're going to, don't worry, I'll tell you who you can use as a contractor. I think this is the guy we should use, right? Notwithstanding that you've set up the contracts the other way, this is what the owner sees. This is what the owner thinks. This is what the owner feels. You've set it up the other way, but damn it, and I'm being recorded, so excuse my language, I relied on you to tell me who to use as the contractor. He's your guy. and you have to wear some of the responsibility for telling me to use this guy because he turned out to be a clown, says the contractor. And you might want to throw your arms up and say, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Client, you're the problem here. The contractor is fine. But it doesn't matter. You're getting dragged into a lawsuit because the owner sees you and the contractor joined at the hip. So you need to be a little careful about putting your guy out there as being the really good guy, because the stronger you are in saying, no, no, use him, use him, use him, he's going to be great, he's going to be great, he's going to be great, the more they're going to make you wear that at the end of the day if they have a problem. They'll bring you in. One of the ways to deal with that I've suggested in the past is, you never award anything to a contractor. All you do is make suggestions or recommendations to the owner. Look, you know, you could pick, I'm going to get some quotes for you. You could pick this guy, you could pick that guy, you could pick the other guy. These two or three guys I've had experience with, they're pretty good, but you need to decide. If you're worried, what you often say to the owner is, and I've put it in contracts, look, I'm going to get quotes from two or three. Three is better, two is minimum. I'm going to get quotes from two or three guys to do this. But if you've got anybody that you would like to quote the work yourself, you tell me who they are and get the quote from them. Because that's how you preserve that relationship. You know, at the end of the day, you make the decision, we'll set up the contracts. You know, I'm not married to any of these guys. Because at the end of the day, you know what? If they want to take your design and hire the clown in the truck to go build it, that's their responsibility. You know, that's their right. I've had some people ask me to put into contracts that, you know, you'll only use my design if we use an approved contractor. Tough to do. Tough to do. Now, I have to fast forward this a little bit. That's the one thing I want you to be careful about when we talk about selecting trades. Now, the second thing I want you to be careful about is, and I've got a lot of slides on this, I'm probably just going to roll right through them fairly quickly. One of the other things I want you to be careful about when we talk about selecting contractors is the formal bidding process. Okay? Bidding and tendering. There is a huge difference in construction between going around and getting a few prices from a few people. What would you charge? What would you charge? What would you charge? And engaging a full-blown tender process. If the owner wants you to engage a competitive process on his behalf, and as your businesses grow and you start doing work for more sophisticated clients, they're going to want that. If you start doing work for municipalities, it's mandated by statute that they have such a process. So if you are starting to get involved in administering those processes, today isn't the day to learn about them. I'm going to kind of highlight it for you, but you need to understand what the rules of bidding and tendering are. Because at the end of the day, you're going to make a recommendation to the owner. And if you've breached your obligations, if you've made some mistakes in administering the process such that somebody can complain about that process, even though the owner awarded the contract, if the owner gets sued for a breach of the tender process, they're going to bring you in. I'll tell you an example about that in a second. Rules of thumb, Supreme Court of Canada, MJB, and also another case, Martel. I could stand up here and often do for 2 or 3 hours and talk about tendering, but at the end of the day, if you are in a tendering process, a competitive process, it's not so simple as the low bidder gets the job. It's definitely true that the tender authority, who will be the owner, will be your client, will have obligations to all the bidders. They can only accept compliant bids. What's a compliant bid? Complies with the terms of the tender documents. Is it that simple? No. Only compliant bids can be considered. You can only disclose on the basis of disclosed criteria. Now think about this, okay? Because if this guy's $2,000 cheaper, but this is the guy you know and you work well with, I know you want to say to the owner, for the $2,000, go with the devil you know. Go with the guy that I know I can work with. It's a good idea. Well, if you're in a full-blown tendering process and the award happens to the second low bidder because of your recommendation that I get along with them better, the owner might get sued and drag you in, and the other side will probably win. I found myself, I'm Roman Catholic, I found myself up in Sudbury examining the archbishop or whoever he was up there for the church because my guy was second low. And or my guy was low, and they awarded to the second low bidder. And the poor bishop is standing there saying, well, you know, we just awarded on the basis of the representation of the consultant who said, pick this guy. And by the time we figured out where the dust was settling, the consultant actually picked the second low guy because somebody's elbows got up literally in the corner in a hockey game. And I didn't want to work with his lead foreman anymore because we went into the boards hard and had a little bit of a scuffle, which was not disclosed criteria, by the way. Right? The idea is, if you're going to invite me to bid on a project, if you're going to invite me to do the work that's involved in bidding this thing, you got to treat me fairly. And if I knew you were going to pick somebody that the consultant was happy with, I wouldn't have wasted my time. If I knew you were just using my price to see if his price is a good price, I wouldn't have wasted my time. If I knew you were going to use a local bidder, and I'm from Toronto bidding up north, and you were going to take a local bidder anyway, I wouldn't have wasted my time. If I knew you were going to award based on what happened in a hockey game, I wouldn't have wasted my time. So if you are getting into a formal bidding process, you need to understand these duties, and it's not nearly as simple as I've laid out for you now. The law of tendering in Canada is extremely complicated, and it's a bit of a moving target in law. So, you know, we write, we speak, we do seminars. If you find yourself doing these things, understand them, because the owner's looking at you to meet their obligations, and you can't meet them if you don't know what they are. Don't award contracts. Only recommend. You know, Mr. Owner, I recommended this guy, but it was your decision at the end of the day. Bidding and tendering, I am just going to... So, the Construction Lien Act. The Construction Lien Act applies to all improvements. And an improvement in Ontario includes any alteration, addition, or repair to land, any demolishment or removal of any building on land. It includes the direction, the construction and installation of virtually anything. We say to the contractors, you've got lien rights when you put down sod, but you don't get lien rights when you cut the grass because you're not altering the land. But you guys aren't building anything. So are you providing services and materials to an improvement? I shouldn't say you're not building anything. Some of you might, but just beware of the design build aspects. Make sure you're insured for it and make sure that you're covered legally in terms of the work that you're physically going to do. But if you're not doing physical work, how do your lien rights arise? Well, the Lien Act does provide that consultants, architects, engineers, people who provide design, do have lien rights. You are bringing a value to the premises. And it doesn't even matter if the design isn't implemented. So long as it was intended that you would be paid for the design, the argument goes that, you know, if I could sell you this farm, I'm going to get $10 million for it. But if I can say, oh, but wait, I've got this nice little design for a subdivision that goes with the farm, then arguably the farm's is worth a little more because I'm selling it with something else attached to it. So the theory is your work has improved the value of the land and accordingly you have lien rights. Well, that's a bit of a double-edged sword. In and around late 1980s, I think, the architects said, oh, we don't want to be covered by the Lien Act anymore. We don't want to be covered by the Lien Act because when you're covered by the Lien Act, you have holdback obligations. When you're covered by the Lien Act, there are trust obligations. Okay, and I'll touch on those in a couple of seconds. And they said, you know, we hire sub-consultants, and when we hire sub-consultants, we don't want to have to deal with holdback, and we don't need to want to worry about trust. So you know what? Carve us out. And so the powers that be said to the architects, okay, we'll carve you out. And they put a line in the Lien Act that said, but it doesn't apply to architects. And those are people who are licensed to practice architecture and registered as licensed architects under the Architects Act. So about, I don't know, 8 years later, the architects say, but we want lien rights. You know, so they go, you can't suck and blow at the same time. You're either in or you're out, right? If you want the remedies, It comes with the obligations. So the architects went away for a little while, and they thought about it, and they came back and said, no, we want back in. We want the remedies of the lien, but I guess now we're going to have to live with the obligations of the Lien Act. Bottom line is, yes, you have lien rights in relation to your design, but you also have the obligations. And the obligations associated with the Lien Act relate to holdback. You're supposed to be retaining 10% of the value of the services and materials that you provide to the premises as they're provided, holding back from your subconsultants. There are also trust obligations at play. When you are paid money from the owner for your work, that owner, that money isn't your money. It doesn't belong to you until everybody you owe money for that work has been paid. And trust obligations mean exactly what you think they mean. And at the end of the day, if the people underneath you on that job don't get paid, the Construction Lien Act can step in and say, you know that corporation you set up to create the corporate veil to make sure that you were going to be insulated personally and you wouldn't lose your house? It doesn't apply here. Okay? So, you know, some of you don't have very much in the way of people underneath you, subconsultants and suppliers, people who do drawings, you know, things like that. But those of you who do, those of you who get a really big job and you need a subconsultant, you need an engineer, you need a geotechnical guy, a lot of work involved, these guys are owed $20,000 or $30,000 each, you don't get paid by the owner on the last draw, the owner that you did, the money that you did get went into overheads, went into this, that, or the other, all of a sudden you've got a problem. So, in dotting the I's and crossing the T's today, one of the things that we would ask you to do is understand what your lien obligations are in relation to construction. So there's only four people in construction as far as the Construction Lien Act is concerned. Okay? One is the owner. One is the contractor. One is the subcontractor. I'm going to grab my pointer. It's only four people in construction as far as the Lien Act is concerned. There's the owner. The owner can be the person you think he is, the guy who's hiring you, but it might also be anybody who has an interest in the land and with whose privity and consent, with whose money, upon whose credit the work is being done. So it can include more than one person. Mortgagees are the people who are paying for the work or the people that have mortgages on the land for other reasons. And there are contractors and subcontractors. There are no architects or engineers or consultants. And there are no suppliers. If you are here in the pyramid, even if you're an architect or an engineer or another consultant, you are a contractor. So when you pull up the Construction Lien Act and it starts talking about the obligations of contractors, that's you, assuming you contracted with the owner. Now, if you're down one level, down here, you're a subcontractor. So if you're hired by the big A architect for the project and he's going to pay you to do the landscape design, you're here. And you are known as a subcontractor, even though you're a design consultant. Same thing for suppliers. The window guy, who isn't really a subcontractor in the usual trade sense of the word, is a subcontractor for the purposes of the act. I'm going to touch on one other thing before I open it up for questions. One of the roles that you can be asked to do on a commercial project is certify completion. So, well, let's back it up a little bit for a few minutes and talk about the contract administration roles that consultants will be asked to do. We're all familiar with the design aspect. I'm going to design it. Going to give you the design, somebody else is going to build it, I might help you find a trade to actually build it. Now, and in doing that, full-blown consultants' contracts that we work on or work with all the time will often be very detailed in terms of that process. You're going to start with, okay, I'm going to give you concept drawings. And if you like the concept, then and we're going to have a meeting, and the meeting's going to be up to 2 hours to talk about the concept. And if it takes any more time, I get paid more money. And then we're going to go to the next stage, and I'm going to develop IFC drawings. And I'll give you those, and then if there are any more changes after that, I get paid for it. Once we get to the IFC drawing stage, we're going to... Lovely. I told a judge in Brantford that I couldn't start a trial today because I was coming to speak to you people, so I've been leaving my phone on all day. Lovely. So, when you move into the contract administration phase, it's after that very detailed process where we've got the design, we've got the IFC drawings, we're ready to go. Contract administration, what are you going to do? You can be doing inspections of the work, which we talked about earlier, and they need to be distinguished from site supervision. You can be preparing deficiency lists when the owner is going to be asking you on the basis of those lists, on the basis of those inspections, to list the deficiencies. Again, you're going to want that contract between the owner and the contractor, you're going to want that to clearly say to the contractor, when the consultant gives you a deficiency list, correct it. Because if that's not in there, the contractor will look at you and go, well, that's nice, who are you? Right? The consultant will often be asked to determine at the end of the day whether or not the contractor should be paid. Whether it's interim stages, you know, he can be paid when the retaining wall's up. He can be paid when we, you know, get to this stage of the work. Or in the usual sense, it's going to be, okay, I'm going to pay you monthly for the work that you've done in that month, and the consultant is going to review how much work has been done to date. And you need to be careful about being categorical about what you say. Whether it's an interim payment or it's the final payment, you know, it's not categorical. You're not guaranteeing the sufficiency of the work. You know, based on my general review of the work, it looks like it generally complies with the contract documents. I'm not aware of any further deficiencies. The deficiencies that I have outlined, it appears to me that they've been corrected. Boom. Without overstating what it is you're going to do. You can be asked to do that. You can be asked to determine whether or not a change in the work should be paid. So when the contractor says to the owner, you know, I'm being asked to do X, and the owner says, no, that was part of your original work. That was part of your original scope. That's not an extra. You can be asked to make that determination as to whether it's a change in the work or whether the contractor should be doing it as part of his price. When a change is actually required, you can be expected by the owner to assess whether or not the dollar value that the contractor is putting it on is a good number. So he says, yeah, another two courses of wall on the wall, it's going to cost you 10 grand. And your contract administration responsibilities might involve your looking at that and deciding whether or not it's a good number. And if it is, you're going to approve the change. And again, it's all part of what your contract says you're responsible to do. You know, saying in your contract, I'm going to administer the contract and not being any more detailed than that can potentially put you in a position where the owner's asking you to do a whole bunch more stuff than what you'd have signed up for. So your contract needs to be very detailed about what it is you're going to sign up to do. And, you know, checklists and long ones and away you go. And at the end of the day, the Construction Lien Act, if you get into it, is going to... if you're in commercial projects, big projects, there's something called a Certificate of Substantial Performance, which is a document that is issued by the owner, and the Lien Act also actually talks about the consultant who does this for the owner, and it says, you know what, you're 97% done, and we can release the basic holdback. And if what I've just said is absolute gobbledygook to you, then all that tells you is that if you find yourself working in commercial projects where there's an expectation that there's going to be a holdback release, a release of this money, upon hitting what the Lien Act describes as substantial performance, you've got to now understand how that happens. It's a mathematical calculation, and they will look for the consultant to do it. So as your business grows and you start, you know, working for municipalities or more sophisticated commercial clients, they'll start looking to you to do these things, and just don't willy-nilly jump in with 2 feet. You need to understand what your obligations are in that regard, even though I can't explain them to you today. So thanks for putting up with me. I'll open it up for a few questions if anybody has any, and then we'll go from there. I think you need to come to the mic. Yeah, you need to come to the mic. We're being videotaped, oh, okay. So smile.
Okay. Hi, my name is Christy. I have a question about incorporation. I've gotten a lot of conflicting advice. At what point you
should I incorporate or not?
What the benefit is? This seems to
all right.
Be
let me wax philosophic very quickly. The only reason you would not incorporate that makes any sense to anyone is if you've got a whole bunch of losses on some side of a ledger personally that you want to take advantage of and bring forward to offset your personal income, then you would leave the income that you're making now in yourself personally because you can take benefit of the losses that you've had previously personally. And that doesn't happen very often. So the only time you would really want to leave your income in your own person is where you can not pay tax on it because of losses you've had otherwise. Beyond that, don't be ridiculous. You have to incorporate. You are in construction. You are building things that can fall down. The corporate shield is what protects you. Now, keep in mind the Construction Lien Act and the trust provisions. It's not always a fail-safe shield, but at the end of the day, if you screw up and the limits of your insurance are $250,000 and your screw-up cost $1 million on top of all the legal fees, right? If it's the corporation that had the problem, you're just putting up your hands and saying it's the insurance company's problem and you're walking away. If it's in you personally, they'll chase you till the end of your days. Incorporation is very, very important to protect yourself personally. You better have some serious losses that you want to bring forward to offset your personal income before you decide not to do it. And, you know, don't come to me. Don't go to a lawyer. Go to a go to an accountant, and a corporation is not that expensive, but you have to do it. And the arguments about, oh, well, you know, we have to have audited financial statements and this, that, and the other, depending on the size of your company, I'll tell you right now, most of you aren't going to have to do that, right? Notes to reader or whatever it is the accountants do will be fine. Talk to an accountant about it, but please do it. Next question? Sir, come to the mic. Sorry. Don't shoot the messenger.
I have a client, one of the counties in Ontario, and they use what we call a request for quotation.
Yes.
Like I'm a consultant. Yep. I do the design and inspect the work, blah, yep. blah, blah. And they say no bid or lowest bid, not necessarily
yep.
accepted.
Yep.
Just basically has to represent best value for the county and stuff like that.
All of that, yep.
Is so that request for quotation format.
Is that a full-blown tender process?
Yeah, or is that an actual entity, or is that just something they made up? Or
let me comment quickly on that. If you're involved in that kind of stuff, you really need to take a bit of a course on bidding and tendering. At the end of the day, if it's a tender, it's a tender. Usually, the indicia of what is a tender and what isn't is the bidders have to keep their prices good for a while. They have to say the price is capable of acceptance for a certain period of time, and in return, you'll treat them fairly. Okay. Sometimes a tender process will be called a request for quotation. Sometimes it will be called a request for proposals. The name doesn't mean anything. If it squawks like a duck, it's a duck. And we see people try to call them other things, but if it's a duck, it's a duck. And you need to look at the actual circumstances and documents to determine whether you're in one of those full-blown tender process. And the starting point is, do you expect this guy to hold his price so that if you accept it, he's obliged to do the work? And if either by implication or in writing, somebody can say that's true, then you may be into the full-blown tender obligations with both feet. Okay? Any more questions? Sure.
Hi, Rob. John Hawks with Wayside.
Hi, John.
Some other things on the go at the moment.
John, good to meet you.
You too. you talked a lot about the downsides of the contractor working for the consultant.
Yes.
Can you flip it around a bit and talk about what pitfalls there are going the other way around, the consultant working for the design build contractor? That's the model we're
sure.
generally in.
Sure. We have lawyers that are often asked to go in-house. And when you go in-house and you work for a construction company, or any other company for that matter, the lawyers will often among themselves kind of shake their head and roll their eyes and say, holy crap, you know, now all of a sudden they want me to be the be-all and the end-all of every piece of legal advice, and they want the answer now, right? So the senior partner has a wills and estates problem, and all of a sudden now it's my problem, and I came over because I have construction expertise. Beware when you are hired as the landscape consultant for a contract or a design build contract. Don't let them overreach. You know, think of yourself as someone having professional obligations, and if you don't have the time to give the proper advice, or you don't have the qualifications to give that advice, and you need to get an engineer involved, you have to say so, because you can end up having a problem. The good news is, you know, it depends on whether you're an employee or not. If you're an employee, of course, the contractor just ends up owning it. But if you're a sub-consultant, you can get dragged in, of course. At the end of the day, if there's a design problem, it should be the contractor that hired you that gets drawn in at first instance, but then they'll bring you in as a third party. So that's the biggest concern I have and I see in that environment, where they expect you to give all this advice that you may not be getting paid for, you may not be insured for, and you may not be qualified to give, and they'll put pressure on you and they'll say, oh, you just tell me what you think. And it brings up another sort of, I talked earlier about putting your design hat on. Be careful about inadvertently putting your design hat on. And I'll finish in a way with a story that scares the hell out of people. There was a pool company in Pickering that gave out pool supplies. And they had a client. They didn't install the pool for them, but the client would come to the pool all the time and to the store all the time to get their pool supplies, their chlorine and their nets and their whatever. So Mom decides that she wants to put a slide in the pool. And Mom goes and looks at the price of new slides, and holy cow, they're way too expensive. She goes on buy and sell, and she buys a slide on buy and sell, and they load it into the pickup truck, and she drives into the parking lot of this store that they've always gone to. And I don't even know if she got out of the car. She said to somebody who had been to her house to clean the pool and stuff in that thing, she said, will this pool work? Will this slide work in my pool? And somebody said, yeah, it should work. Now, the predictable happened. Okay, we're talking about a catastrophic paralegic injury. And the store wore it. You need to be absolutely clear with yourself and with your employees that you do not overreach with your design advice. You don't throw something out like, it should work. Because you can end up wearing it. And heaven forbid you're not incorporated. And heaven forbid it's the guy that you're working for who's pushing you to do it and isn't even the end client. Be careful about that. You live in a litigious society. Unfortunately, it's getting a little worse. It ain't getting better. Do I have time for more questions? Probably a couple of minutes. Any more questions? Apparently, we have no more time for questions. Thanks for putting up with me. Enjoy the conference.
Thank you, Rob. Nice, great presentation, always informative. And as a token of our appreciation and thank you, we have a gift for you.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, so this moves us on to our keynote speaker for the afternoon. This presentation is going to be split up into two components. So we're going to have a half-hour presentation. We're going to break for 10 minutes, just a quick refreshment break, and then we will continue with the rest of the presentation. So it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Diarmaid Gavin. Diarmaid studied amenity horticulture at the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin in Dublin. Following this, he established his own UK-based garden design business. Diarmaid's distinctive garden style has brought him worldwide acclaim. In 2011, saw Diarmaid's ambitious garden in the sky design awarded the gold prestigious award at the Chelsea Flower Show. He's currently developing his ninth Chelsea offering, the largest exhibit ever displayed there, and it's the Chocolate Factory Garden. Diarmaid has worked for all the main broadcasters, both in radio and television in the UK and Ireland. and is currently on a daily morning show and has also been presenter and garden designer on several television programs. He has been awarded an honorary Doctor of Art in recognition of his contribution to garden design, is a patron of the Southport Flower Show, Trees for Cities, Cricklewood Homeless Concern, and is a supporter of the Nile Mellon Trust, Township Trust, the Rose Project, which supports AIDS sufferers in Africa, and David has authored 11 books. He currently runs a Dublin-based garden design studio with clients in Europe, South Africa, and the Middle East, and has recently worked with Moscow City Council examining the work in Russian contemporary designers. So it's my great pleasure to introduce David Gavin to the stage.
Great, thank you. Afternoon, everyone. That sounded like an obituary, didn't it? Anyway, I'm still here. I'm absolutely delighted to be here at the Garden Designers Conference. It's a real honour to be asked to come across the Atlantic and talk about work we do elsewhere. Rob's talk was, it made me feel like a small child in a way, because he went through every mistake I've ever made, and in some ways continue to make in garden design. It was absolutely fascinating, made me feel I should grow up, and from the evidence that you'll see, you'll soon realize that I haven't grown up. I'm a garden designer, born in London, but brought up in Dublin, and I always liked the idea. How does this thing work? Is this the... I was told there was a red and... it's that one. I always liked the idea of creating gardens, but I was brought up in the suburbs. This is Mum and Dad. They moved. They were born in East inner city Dublin, so they had no relationship with gardens. They moved to London when they got married, and then eventually, a month after I was born, they moved back to Dublin and bought a house in the suburbs. So the first garden I ever... That's the house where Mum still lives, in a place called Rathfarnham, just about 5 miles from Dublin city centre. So it's the suburbs, exactly the same as the suburbs anywhere else. So the first 20 years of my life were pretty much spent in this house. Those birch trees that you see there, I grew them from seed when I was in the National Botanic Gardens. But I love the idea of work. I love design. I love being outside. I love the local park. But I absolutely hated the first garden I ever saw being created, because it was the same as every other garden. So, however, the first person that created that's Dad, wasn't he a bit of a cool dude? I was a real disappointment to him, as you can see. But he was my first, in a way, hero as a garden designer, because he's the first person I ever saw create a garden. Himself and my uncle dug out... took away all the stones, raked away all stones and weeds, and created a garden. Now, this is my uncle's front garden, which remains exactly the way it was back in 1971, I think it was. And this, everybody in the 70s, where I grew up, where I saw my first garden being created, did exactly the same thing. You put a lawn in, and in the middle of a lawn, you planted a tree. Any ideas what that tree was? It was always the same. No, it wasn't the birch. I got very contemporary years later. It was a cherry tree, because the little girls making their first Holy Communion, you know, looked very pious under this cloud of pink petals. So it was a cherry tree. Around the edge of the lawn, you were allowed borders, and the borders were always exactly that width. And do you know what you planted in the borders? And everybody did the same. I don't know, was it the same in Canada? Blue and white and blue and white and blue. And that was it. Lobelia and Alison. That was the height of garden design. Unless you were incredibly pretentious, or heaven forbid if you were Protestant, you were red. maybe red salvias or orange marigolds or something like that, but it was blue and white, and you dare not do anything different. Sometimes, I was into Cub Scouts, and sometimes, you know, I'd do this thing called Baba Job, and I'd go to the posher houses, and they'd have beds of roses, you know, always the same color, hybrid tea roses, but that was very posh. In the back garden, you were allowed something different. If two walls collided together, you were allowed to throw a whole load of stone, soil dotted with stones, and put in alpines, created a rockery, and pretended you lived in the Cotswolds or something like that, someplace like that. And of course, crazy paving was the rigor. That's what everybody had to have. So that was my upbringing in the suburbs. Everything was exactly the same. I lived in Dublin, not in London, where things might have been exciting, not in Toronto, not in New York. And things seemed very safe, but bloody hell, they seemed very boring. So my whole concept of wanting, I love being outside, I love being in the local park, quite like design, but I was watching television, I was, you know, in the age of Star Trek and all sorts of other things, and I couldn't understand, you know, having this desire to get out and to work in the garden, but not do what everybody else was doing. If Spock was, you know, beamed down to another planet and you saw these big triffid-like plastic plants probably somewhere in a soundstage in Los Angeles, that was the type of thing, that was the type of place I wanted to go. Inspiration, so all sorts of different inspiration. This is a sofa by an American guy, George Nelson, 1950s, I think. Color, I love color in all its forms. Not so much. Ireland is we have a lot of green, 40 shades or 400 shades. So in terms of planting, I tend to keep it green or look at the natural landscape and try and replicate some of the, some simple planting from the natural landscape, but in everything else, I like to be very vibrant and very, very colourful. The natural landscape, this is just in Sligo in the west of Ireland. This is just a hawthorn that has, you know, seeded itself and survived growing from the side of a mountain. And it's natural. It looks a bit like my hair, doesn't it? Looks a little bit wild. Beautiful countryside. This is in England, in a garden, actually, in Chatsworth House in Derbyshire. Capability Brown landscape. But who wouldn't like that? So I like weird stuff like Star Trek, and I like kind of normal stuff too. I like seeing, I travel an awful lot, and this is driving through South Africa and just seeing, you know, the mountains, the lines in the mountains, but also those curves and lines. This field had just been cropped or whatever, combine harvester had just gone through, and the lines that it left. And I hop out of the car and take photographs wherever I go. The type of planting I like, sand dunes, right beside me in County Wicklow, where I live now. I just love this as natural planting. So this is marron grass, which is binding all the seashore together. And when the wind, and we get quite a lot of wind in Ireland, mind you, we don't get weather like you get weather. I love the texture of that, and a lot of my type of planting is dealing with different shades of green and different textures. Again, the wild, we saw the birch tree I grew from seed. This is birch growing on a hillside, again in Sligo. But ranunculus, the you know, type of color you might get from a John Waters movie, maybe. This is in a place called Kaikoura in New Zealand. I just saw somebody had obviously sprinkled some ranunculus from a packet of seed, and every shade of clashing color you can imagine created this big statement. I like rockeries, but not the tiny ones we made in Rathfarnham. This is a massive rockery built by Paxton in the 1700s in Chatsworth House, again, in Derbyshire. And it reminds me of Tonto and the Lone Ranger, you know, big, creating big canyons. So I like drama. And more simple drama, back to Kaikoura in New Zealand, and just beautiful local native gardens with and the ability to travel and the ability to see different things. As gardeners, we're very, very lucky. You know, when you see chefs on the television, you can get any ingredient these days from all around the world. With gardeners, to see something different, okay, we can go to hothouses and whatever, but if you travel and see plants that are very dramatic in their native environment, it lifts your spirit and it never stops you learning. Different landscapes. So this would be a landscape that has inspired one of the Chelsea Gardens I've done. done. So it's just lavender been grown commercially in a field in Provence. So the field is falling down, and in Ireland this would be potatoes. It wouldn't be anything as romantic as landscapers, but you have those drills for the machinery to go up and down and cut the crop. Ireland is an ancient land, a dolmen burial site, about 2,500 years old. And I've put this in just to show that as long as we've been around, we have an effect on the landscape. We change things. It's in our nature to create and to change and to leave mementos of ourselves. Just a place called Gugunbarra in West Cork is a very beautiful place. But traveling again, this is a garden that's a definite inspiration for a few different reasons. First of all, if you want to see a cactus and succulent garden, this is the Yves Saint Laurent, Laurent garden, Villa Margerelle, I think it's called, in Marrakesh. And it's absolutely gorgeous. For the planting that's been achieved there, a French painter spent about 50 years living and working in this, but also the color of, the color, the cobalt blue. The color of the house and the rills and any of the features, that bright, beautiful blue that seems to absorb sunshine. So I love taking, being inspired by color and bringing it into gardens. Roberto Berlay Marx, I came across him when I was a student in college, a Brazilian garden designer who you're probably familiar with, who obviously liked having fun. He was a graphic designer, so he did training, and I think a furniture designer also, but really appreciated the native indigenous flora in Brazil and used as much as he could in the gardens that he created all around his country. Architecture, that's a little bit different. This is the Bubble House, and it's in the south of France, designed by a Hungarian architect who didn't feel that walls had to be straight. He wanted to push the boundaries in a different way. I think he only built two or three houses in his life. He's still living. He lives in a miniature bubble house just up the hill from this one here, and he's really quite eccentric. We were at an extraordinary thing for me because I went to visit this house. We were filming something in New York about 10 years ago, and I got Architectural Digest on the plane to read on the way back, and this house was featured in it because it was for sale. There was an advertisement for it, and the following week, because we were making huge amount of television programs that needed material, the following week I was jumping over the rooftops of this house in the south of France, using it as inspiration for a garden we were to make in suburban England, a garden that would scare the neighbours, as you can imagine. I was jumping over this house, and subsequently, friends of ours bought this house in the south of France, and we celebrated their 50th birthday in it just this summer, and the architect was coming down from his little bubble house then, and everybody was told how to talk to the man, because everybody said, whoever designed this house must be a genius, and they said, well, don't say that to him, because one woman, you know, told him last year at some sort of party that he was a genius, and he said, Madame, you have shit taste. somebody with different eyes. This would be my hero in terms of garden design. So now you know what you're dealing with. I'll get my apologies in early. Willy Wonka. I kind of prefer the old Willy Wonka, but either of them will do. And gardens that are a true inspiration, contemporary gardens. This is, as you all know, the High Line in New York. And I don't know how many, I think I've been visiting this garden for about 5 years. And I was there last Sunday, and even though it was in midwinter and it was freezing, you couldn't see space for people. People walking through, floating above the meatpacking district in New York, floating over a city in what was an abandoned space. That has been created into this most remarkable garden. And I realized on this visit to the High Line, compared to the type of gardens I grew up with and the type of gardens that were shown to me as being great, that the gardens with the roses or the Italianate gardens or the Oriental gardens, for many, many people, their first introduction to public gardens, gardens in the public realm, will be, you know, an Irish bog, which is in effect a type of planting that's on the High Line in the middle of Manhattan. Really quite a remarkable achievement, and one which fills me with glee and great hope for the future of garden design. Such a simple but wonderful idea, and it's put garden visiting at the heart of people's, you know, visit to that great city. So that's Manhattan. We do quite a lot of work in townships in South Africa and also for private clients in South Africa, and this had all, I've been going to South Africa for 10 years, and this is in Cape Town, and you know, the local councils are, I don't know, well, I do know what your local city council is like in Toronto. We all do. But they're the same the world over. They were building a motorway through Cape Town, and somebody forgot to buy the land, and one guy wouldn't sell. So they're left with this. And I always wanted to build a garden up there, because right beside the city, but on the coast. So you could you imagine the maritime garden that you could create with cafes and water running down. And I know Rob is thinking, can you imagine the liabilities? And color, this was in San Francisco, just in an outdoor cafe. How color through found objects is, you know, it well inspires me or creates decoration. Grand garden buildings, this is in the north of Ireland on the Antrim coast, and this is a library in a garden pavilion that a bishop owned right by the sea. Isn't it magnificent? Architecture through the ages. Berthold Lodbeckian and the Tetron Group in London, Regent's Park Zoo. It was the penguin enclosure, and it was created in the 1950s, I think it was. And just the material that it uses really inspires me, because it's concrete, but it's concrete made to feel very light and airy. Two concentric ramps intertwining, dancing with each other. Absolutely fascinating. It's a nested building, and a couple of years ago, built, as I say, for the penguins. And they took the penguins out to restore the building about 7 or 8 years ago. And they discovered that the penguins began to mate like hell in their temporary enclosure. They absolutely hated this. But as a piece of architecture, I think it's very nice. I bring a camera. And now it's so easy with the camera phones, wherever I go. And this is in a shop in New York. They caught me taking a photograph, and they kicked me out, but I could still take the photograph from outside. I asked the shop assistant who had designed it, and it was some very posh architect or whatever, and I'm sure it cost a fortune. But it made me think of creating a garden. I've done gardens in cages before, but there's, you know, Islamic gardens that have beautiful, intricate patterns, and it struck me that something similar could be done for a show garden somewhere by creating a cage, a very beautiful gilded cage that the plants would burst through. Just very simple design features. This was a door grill, a security grill, and a door in Venice Beach, Los Angeles, Giant's Causeway, again in County Antrim, which is a fantastic natural rock. I'll show you later. We did a garden in Chelsea a couple of years ago called the Irish Sky Garden, and I took the influence. I had a lot of pools in the ground, and I took the influence from this rock formation where water was lodging on stones at different levels. There's the big big stones of Chatsworth again. So that's what really gets me going, from television programs, from, you know, Michael Jackson videos before he was mad when he danced down the street, and, you know, every time his feet touched the sidewalk, it illuminated, and watching all things like that, and then going out and looking at my parents' garden and the blue and white. I wanted to bring one into the other and see what we could do in terms of the world of garden design. I was very confused. I grew up, as I say, in Ireland. It's a place with a temperate climate, so we have a lack of extremes. We have an awful lot of rain, but really a lack of extremes of hot or cold or wet or dry. And because of the Gulf Stream, you know, washing the coastline, we share that with that kind of climate with many parts of Britain. It means that we can grow a huge amount of plants. Our next door neighbours were growing up were the British, who were always an affluent nation, or it was always an awful lot of money, because they went out and conquered the world, and they, you know, took stuff back to Britain, they took ideas back to Britain, they sent out people to bring plants back, they brought back ideas from about design and about painting, about art, about architecture, from France and from Germany, and in terms of gardens, they took these ideas in, and they made them their own, and they re-exported them back, and then they developed their own styles of landscape, the parkland style that we'll know, that Capability Brown did, or the Gertrude Jekyll style of the English cottage garden. But that's what I grew up with. And a young lad in Dublin in the suburbs watching Star Trek and watching pop videos, it meant nothing to me. I wanted to be out there using contemporary influence. I was very frustrated by... I left school at 18 and was expected to achieve nothing, so I had an easy ride at home. And I went and I started working in a restaurant because I wanted to do something that was creative. And I worked there for about, you know, 4 or 5 months. And I suppose I could have been Gordon Ramsay, but I left to work in a garden shop because I realized after 4 or 5 months, even though I loved it in the kitchen, I haven't been in the kitchen since, I loved it in the kitchen. I wanted, gardening was my thing. So I worked in a plant shop in Dublin city center called Mackie's, which had been going from, Mackie Seeds, which had been going for since the 1700s. And that was great seeing, you know, the whole of Dublin come in to buy their seeds and their garden provisions and learn something then. And from there, I went and I studied after 3 years in the Botanic Gardens in Dublin. And, you know, they were very good in terms of the science of gardening, in terms of what you needed to know about plant identity, because we had a, we were in the middle of this wonderful botanic gardens with thousands and thousands of species. And every, you know, Friday afternoon, you'd get a plant ID exam, and from a twig at this time of year, you'd have to name genus and species and whatever. So however, I really wanted to know about design and doing things that were slightly different than what was happening in other places around the world. And our design tutoring was giving us crayons and a piece of paper the first day we were there and saying, you're on your own, do it yourself. So I wasn't going to learn anything in college about design, which was a huge frustration for me. But I realized later, the great thing about that is nobody told me what not to do. So I went out, you know, graduated from college, and I really wanted to change the world of garden design and do gardens that were different, but nobody was having it. You know, the pretty people around Dublin wanted pretty gardens, and they wanted what they'd always had. So I got a van and I went round and I started creating these gardens for people. And, you know, I'd go to the garden shows. I started doing the flower shows, and I'd do things like this, you know, move an Irish cottage from halfway across the country, from Achill Island to Dublin, and build it in the showground, and we'd win the gold medal because I can design pretty gardens on the back of an envelope and achieve everything you're meant to achieve. But it wasn't satisfying me. And after a couple of years, I started doing my work incredibly badly and letting people down and bouncing checks. And a couple more years, I lost the van, and then it came to the day where the guy, I was in this rented flat, and I wasn't young, I was about 27 at that stage. I was in a rented flat in Skid Row in Dublin, and the guy came to repossess my stereo system. You know, that stack system of the record player and the tape deck. And it was the most pathetic scene ever. My flatmate was furious at me because I hadn't paid the rent for months and she hadn't known. The guy was coming to repossess that, and I was out in the street. And I was really at the lowest of the low because I had ambition, and everybody around me was saying, well, you go to all these shows and you can get the gold medal, why don't you make something of it? But it wasn't making, nobody wanted what I wanted to give. I didn't even know what I wanted to give. I couldn't go to somebody's house and say, did you see that Billie Jean video? Well, I want to do that in your garden, because I would have been, you know, in the local mental hospital. And around this time, I got a book, and if you ever come across it, it's worth noting. Paradise Transformed, Private Gardens of the 21st Century, by a guy, two guys, Gordon Cooper and Guy Taylor, an English guy, an American guy. And it was reviewed in the Irish Times, and I saw this a black and white picture of the front cover of this book. And the front cover was, do you know Charles Jenks' Garden of Cosmic Speculation in Scotland? the wildest garden you'll ever see. I may have some images of it a little bit later. So this private gardens of the 21st century showed me that stuff was happening somewhere. And there was a story in it about this landscape architect from America, I think from the Boston area, called Marta Schwartz. And there were pictures of the garden that she created, the Bagel Garden. Have you come across the Bagel Garden? So it was in Boston, a fairly conservative part of the United States, in the front of a townhouse, and there was a square of Buxus sempervirens, and nicely clipped, taking its origin from Italian Renaissance garden, maybe. So a nice square of Buxus sempervirens, about 2.5 foot tall. Then there was a little channel, and she planted another square of Buxus sempervirens. But in between the two squares, she put purple aquarium gravel. And on top of the purple aquarium gravel, she placed bagels. You know what, you do know what bagels are. I can have difficulty with this description in Ireland or England, but bagels have the holes in the center. And she placed these bagels, and everybody, because she was quite well known in landscape design circles, everybody went mad. What is this woman doing? And she said, well, bagels, they're the perfect landscape material. They're cheap, easily available, biodegradable, and they do well in the shade. And I thought, well, you know, the start of irony or humor or somebody doing something different, even in a small garden, even if you didn't have millions of dollars for big estates to create gardens of cosmic speculation. So that led me to think, well, what could I do? So these were the type of garden shows I did in Ireland. And this was my final garden show in Ireland, and it won the gold medal, and it's fairly pedestrian, you can see. The hint of a rockery is there, the pavilion and the water feature. But somebody was passing the garden one day, and she was a gardening journalist, and she turned to her friend. She'd been in the Botanic Gardens. She'd been a tutor in the Botanic Gardens, so I knew her of old. And the Chelsea Flower Show had been on the week previously, and she turned to her friend, and she said, that's almost Chelsea standard. And Chelsea wasn't such a big, it's become a huge occasion, a huge television occasion, but back then it wasn't such a big thing. But when I overheard her say this, I thought, well, maybe this is my escape. Maybe going to this thing called the Chelsea Flower Show, doing a garden there, which is wildly different, will be the thing that will, even though I don't have a penny, even though I'm sleeping on friends' sofas, maybe that'll be the thing to change things. So that's what I tried to do. This is the gates of the Royal Hospital in SW1 on the banks of the Thames, and you know, through those gates, eventually my life was to change. It's really quite a remarkable place for me, but it wasn't going to be easy. I was terribly shy. I was 27, 28, and I was absolutely shy. And I looked up the phone book for the Chelsea Flower Show, and it wasn't listed in any international directory. And so I got a friend of mine to ring the Royal Horticultural Society, and he couldn't get through. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I have to get in touch with these people because they have to know that I exist. I have to go over and I have to do a garden and let them know all about myself and my ideas. And we eventually found an address somewhere, 18 AC Vincent Square, SW1 in London. So we took, it was the days when it cost about 300 quid to fly to the UK. So we embarked on a 12-hour journey by boat and train, borrowing the money, ending up in the place that all Irish end up in London, in Kilburn, where a friend was digging roads. We slept on his the floor of his flat, and he said, what are you doing here? I said, we're going to the Chelsea Flower Show, and we're, you know, going to tell them we want to do a garden. And he'd never heard it. Anyway, the following day, the three of us arrived at this building in the centre of London, and it was a lovely spring day. I'll never forget it. And, you know, they have a cricket green outside. Of course they do. People playing cricket and students milling around the place and up these austere steps to the Royal Horticultural Society. And there was a porter there, and he said, can I help you? And I said, yes, I want to do a garden at the Chelsea Flower Show. And he said, show's department is on floor 5. So we went up the winding staircase to floor 5, and somebody eventually came out to see us. And he said, can I help you? Looking as, you know, we look like Irish navvies, looking us up and down. And I suggest I'd want to do a garden at the Chelsea Flower Show. And in his most English of ways, he looked at us and said, you cannot walk in off the street and ask to do a garden at the Chelsea Flower Show. And I said, what do you do? And he said, you address a letter typed to Miss Mavis Sweeting, and outlining all the type of work you've done, all your achievements, give photographic evidence, and say what you would like to do at Chelsea. And he sent us off, you know, and we were never going to darken his door again. And I was absolutely humiliated and ashamed and red-faced. And I thought, again, the dreams are about to be dashed. And what am I going to do now? I'm never going to get into Chelsea. But one of the lads, Vincent, went off. I said, will you find me a typist? And myself and Eamon went to a cafe. And I wrote this letter to the Chelsea Flower Show. And it described, you know, the thriving business I had back in Dublin. And there... Our next job was the landscaping of a roof garden in Beirut in the Lebanon, which was going through interesting times. And Vincent came back and he'd found a Canadian lady on Elizabeth Street. And if we went down there, she'd type our letter. And the three of us went down there, ran down to Elizabeth Street, and she buzzed us in. And she lived in a very posh flat. And up we went. And she didn't know there was going to be three of us. And she thought she was done for. And she asked the other two lads, who wrote this? She said, I can't read it. She asked the two other lads to sit on the sofa and put the dog on them, and I had to read out the letter. And by the end, because she was Canadian, she didn't charge us, she was smiling, she sent us off. And we went back to the 80 Vincent Square, and they were closed. And anyway, I said, well, that's the end of that dream. I slid the letter in under the door, and off we went back to Ireland. A couple of months later, something quite amazing happened. I'd call into my parents' house occasionally. It was the only address I had. And there was a letter there from the Royal Horticultural Society in a real Harry Potter way. I'd never given them my parents' address, and there was no stamp on it. And it was an application to submit a design for the following year's Chelsea Flower Show. Yeah, this was, to me, amazing. Everything was going to change. So I read down through it and whatever. And I thought, right, what will I do to get into Chelsea? What type of gardens would we do? So I'd seen Chelsea on television that year, and I realized that if you brought a garden from a different country, if you were coming from Japan, you brought a Japanese garden. And I thought, right, think cutely about this. You know, give them what they expect the first year, ye old Irish rambling garden, and then the following year come back and do your Michael Jackson thing. So I hopped in the battered van and drove around the country and designed this garden called To the Waters and the Wild, based on a Yeats poem. And it was a wild Irish landscape, and there was to be a crumbling tower falling down and all reflected in this still pool. And, you know, very quaint and very... nothing at all that I believed in, but I felt that something that we could pull off. And I submitted my plans, did up the drawings, sent them off to Chelsea, and waited and waited and waited. And eventually, months later, the letter came back, and I ripped it open, and it said, "Dear Mr. Gavin, we regret to inform you." And there was my dreams dashed one more time. And I remember cycling, because I'd lost a van at this stage, I'd crashed it, absolutely no money, cycling down the parents' driveway. God knows where I was going to. And I said, will you never listen to everybody? This isn't going to happen. And, you know, just get your act together and do whatever you should do. And a couple of months went by, and, you know, I was given Hedges Mohican haircuts or doing something, cutting grass or whatever, and, you know, boring people to death about dreams and whatever. And I arrived back in my parents' house for Friday evening dinner, and my mom said to me, by the way, there was a message on the answer phone from a Miss Mavis Sweetingham. And I rang this woman in the Royal Horticultural Society. Somebody had dropped out. I only had 6 months, but could I get that garden design ready? And if I could, she'd let me in. So I immediately, the following week, got over this amazing budget airline called Ryanair had started, and it only cost me 50 old Irish pounds to get to London. And I stopped on an off license, and I bought her a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream along the way, and feeling that that might, you know, oil the cogs a little bit. It didn't. And she looked at me sternly across her big desk and said, listen, you need at least 60,000 to put a... I hadn't a penny. 60,000. You have 6 months. It's an ambitious garden. Are you going to... And I lied through my teeth and said, yes, sponsor lined up and whatever. And went back to Dublin thinking, woo, we're going to Chelsea. the next, I suppose, 5 months, yeah, well, 4 months were an absolute nightmare. Nobody cared. Absolutely nobody cared. I got one radio interview to do, and I went in and to this studio for the Irish National Broadcaster, and the guy said to me, £60,000, I'd buy a red Ferrari. What would I do bringing a garden to London? So absolutely nobody cared. So to cut a long story short, I decided to do all sorts of odd things. At one stage, I just took to the bed, hoping somebody else would sort it, and everybody was saying, what the hell are you doing? Tell them you're not coming. So on the first week of May in 2004, myself and the only friend I had probably at the time arrived in London with two suitcases, and we walked in through those gates straight from the airport and down to a plot of ground, and it was a railway sleeper, and the word Gavin was printed out in front of that, and I had 3 weeks and 3 days and £300 in my pocket to create this garden that I'd promised them. My plants, I did have some plants. I'd gone down to County Kerry, which is in the southwest corner of Ireland, with fertilizer bags and an old van, and we dug up everything we could find. They were been stored in somebody's backyard, and I had a pile of stone in Dublin. And what happened over the next 3 weeks and 3 days is quite amazing. But we got the garden built eventually. That was the plot. Actually, it's the same plot that I've had for the last few years at Chelsea. That's Rockbank Garden site that it's called. And we built the garden that they expected. And there you have the, you can see that it's very green. All sorts of things happened. When our plants arrived in these fertilizer bags from Ireland, you know, frogs hopped out, and we discovered that a cow had got in and did some very handy pruning for us. And we hadn't got any money to build the pond. We had no money for butyl liner in Chelsea that year, so we taped with two sheets of polythene together, and it was the only pond in Chelsea that didn't leak that year. And it wasn't my dream garden by a long stretch of the imagination, but we'd got to Chelsea and we sold the garden for about £2,000, so we had enough money to get home. And you know, we were sitting in a pub a couple of weeks after. Nobody noticed. Nobody had any clue that we'd been over to Chelsea. It hadn't worked. And I was sitting in a pub a couple of days later, and I was talking to a girl and saying, well, you know, we did this and we did that and we've just come on. And I was telling the stories of not having any food, not eating for the final 3 days of building this, not having any accommodation for the final week, and asking the police could we stay in their cells in Chelsea. And I was telling this girl the story, and she rang me the following day, and she says, what you don't know is I'm a researcher for the Late Late Show, which is the longest running chat show in the world, and they'd been going 35 years, 40 years at that stage, and they'd never had a gardener on. And she said to me, we have the Premier of Newfoundland on next week, and I reckon he's going to be very boring. Will you come on and tell your story? And the thing about Chelsea, in Dublin, I'd always won gold at the shows. And in Chelsea, you get a bronze medal for turning up. There's 25 gardens there, and you get a bronze medal if you turn up and do anything. And we got a bronze medal, you know, for the garden. And it wasn't about the medals. And I learned a very valuable lesson that year, because everybody was obsessed about gold, gold. All the other first-time designers, they just wanted gold. And we got bronze and whatever. And there were four or five bronze handed out. And then there was silver gilts, silver and silver gilts, maybe six or seven of them. And then there was four or five golds, and it was one best in show. And we had bronze. But I went on the Late Late Show back in Dublin the following week, and I told them we got bronze. Everybody thought we came third, and we were away. I'll continue after. We're going to break now for about 15 minutes, and I'll continue our adventures in Chelsea and television land afterwards. Thank you very much.